Coming up next, this week, computer hardware, cheap GPUs, Corsair's first mini ITX case, speed for designers, we can make Adobe Creative Suite run faster, a sick water cooling system, and more. It's all coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 254, recorded February 13th, 2014. Cheap GPUs and speed for designers.
This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Ting.com. Ting is a mobile phone service that makes sense. Save money with Ting. Pay only for what you use. Ting doesn't require a contract and offers unlimited devices on one shared plan. To save $25 on your first Ting device, visit twitch.ting.com. That's twitch.ting.com.
Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, the Twit weekly show that aims to bring you the most useful, the most fun, the most informative, and most powerful news in computer hardware. And we talk about tablets and phones and stuff, but mostly we talk about PC hardware. And Ryan Trout, who hopefully is now covered with puppies and filled with love, right there in Kentucky. It's funny, I'm looking at the right side of my monitor, which is the wrong side to be looking at Ryan. Television is popular people. Dude! Are you still under, like, snowpocalypse, or are you just freezing right now?
No, actually, we got above freezing 2 days in a row, yesterday and today. But I think it's supposed to snow again tomorrow, maybe 2 inches or something like that. But at this point, we were talking earlier, 2 inches might as well be no snow. I'm totally fine with that. And I think somewhere in the extended forecast, which puts it in the 7 to 10 day time frame, we saw 60. On there. So I'm okay with
60 degrees or 60 inches of snow.
Yes. No, 60 degrees, not 60 inches of snow. No, that's a good correct. Thing. Yeah, that's very good.
And somehow in my mind, I was going to make this elegant segue from you freezing in part of the country that shouldn't be quite that cold to the new Coolant EXT440CU liquid cooling system with CPU 380i water block. A review that Maury wrote up at PCPer.com. It was funny. I was just telling somebody last week that for the most part, you really don't need water cooling because air coolers, even some of the least expensive ones, are fantastic and amazing and do a great job, even if you're overclocking. But this, ladies and gentlemen, I'm looking at the picture of it right now, the EXT440. This is a fancy-looking piece of kit.
How to test it's pretty that. Cool.
Yeah, it's gorgeous.
It's actually the part I find interesting about it is that so, you know, a long time ago when people did water cooling, it was a very, very complicated setup, right? You usually bought your pumps independent from your radiators, independent from your reservoirs, independent from your pipe, your tubes, independent from your fittings.
And I had $200 into my last serious water cooling system, not counting the $60 I spent for a car radiator with an electric fan on it because I was tired of chintzy little $75 radiators from the water cooling store.
Yeah. So, and then... You know, that water cooling was complicated. It was there was maintenance involved, quite a bit of maintenance involved. And so we started to see the release of these self-contained water coolers. That is, there was a like the water block and pump were on one unit, and then the reservoir and radiator were one unit and fixed to each other by permanent tubing. And those have been very popular. The Corsair series, Antec series, Thermaltake makes some as well. This Coolance is a company that's been around for a very, very long time, and they were kind of one of the progenitors of the old style of water cooling. And they actually had some of these really cool – they made cases that had kind of all the water cooling components built into it, so you just added components. And then they also had these kind of add-on portions that would actually sit on top of your case that would have the reservoir and pump and radiator kind of in an external unit that have like a little LED display to tell you the temperatures and that kind of thing. It was pretty cool. I have two. Exos, Coolant's Exos, I think is what it was called. EXOS.
A little bag of antifreeze that came inside.
Yeah. And that's like the only thing I ever had to replace. And it had like a, like something you used a coin to open up top. You could add in some more of the coolant fluid. It was pretty neat. I only spilled stuff all over things one time. So that's a pretty good ratio of disaster to not disaster, I guess. So this Coolant EXT440CU is, it's kind of a hybrid between the self-contained stuff we have and the fully custom stuff, kind of in line with the Exos units that you and I have and had used in the past, right? So it's got the radiator and the pump and the reservoir kind of all together. But this is actually a unit that actually mounts in the 5 1/4 inch drive bays of your system. So it's in it, and it allows you to use, you still have to use tubing. You still have to have an external water block for either your CPU or your GPU or both. And so it kind of gives you flexibility and it gives you some additional performance that you don't see with the self-contained units. And actually, Maury wrote this review up for us. And it actually, he also tested it with the, what's the exact model number here? The CPU380i CPU water block. The self-contained unit is $275 sticker price, and the water block was $75 sticker price. So you're talking about $350 investment for this. It's not nearly as reasonably priced as, say, like a Corsair H100i or, you know, an Antec cooler type device.
But it looks really cool.
Yeah, it does. Like, if you look at the pictures on the second page or the pictures of it throughout the article where it's installed, mm-hmm. it just looks nicer. Right, it just, this looks like a higher performance piece of equipment. It kind of reminds me of the good days of water cooling, where you had to know something, you had to really, really want to water cool it, which I think is actually a neat thing to bring back. Right, you had to try to do it. It wasn't just something. Well, yeah, of course I've got water cooling. I bought it because it's also as inexpensive as high end air coolers today. Right. But if you go down a couple more pictures in that on that page, you'll see it, the water block attached to the motherboard. It's an MSI Big Bang board, and it just looks cool. Like, yeah. Two more down, I think.
It looks like it should be in some back corner of the Star Trek engine room.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then Maury walks through, you know, the installation. He walks through setup. He walks through kind of, you know, getting everything up and running. And it's really not that intimidating of a process. You got to take your time. You've got to make sure that you're giving yourself enough room to do the things you need to do. You're careful with the fluid that's involved and everything. And but it's pretty neat to see some sort of a return to that. I would say in the last month or two, I've thought about, like, yeah, I should really build a computer with, like, water cooling. And anytime I go out of town to a show and they have – when we were at CES, they had these, you know, machines that had triple SLI in them with water blocks and, you know, great lighting in it and maybe UV reactive tubes or coolant liquid. I'm like, you know what? I should have something like this, right? That's the kind of work that I'm in. That sounds like this is something that I should have. And at the end of the day, I always come back to it and I go, I don't really have time to set that up.
Could, if you wanted to, you could set a little bit of time each day.
Could. You know,
because Lord knows you've got the parts lying around you in that office right now. I want to be hard and cruel here for a moment, because I love the way this thing looks, and it would be a magnificent addition to any case, especially some of the Corsair cases we saw, the 540 that we saw at the Corsair booth, but it was a hotel suite. The white one with the window and just the magnificent airflow management. But if you go down the second page, CPU temperature, Ivy Bridge CPU stock settings, you know, the Coolant EXT440CU, it's interesting looking at the thermals on this, because if you look all the way down at the bottom of this chart at 35 degrees Celsius and 12 degrees Celsius at load and at idle, pretty much leading the pack, at least at load, maybe not so much at idle, is actually a $100 Thermalright Silver Arrow SBE, currently unavailable, but, you know, a fairly serious high-end fan, but still less than a third of the cost of this water cooling kit. And then you go down to CPU temperature, Ivy Bridge, CPU overclock settings. And again, you're looking at 57 degrees at load, 15 degrees at idle. So a degree or two higher at idle, which I don't particularly care about the idling temperature of my CPU, but a few degrees lower at the high end, again, for one third the cost. Now, what's going on with the Haswell CPU settings? Because it looks like you're finally starting to see some advantages for the EXT440CU.
Yeah, so under Haswell, the performance, especially on the overclocked settings, showed some advantages there, right? So you're looking at average through all core, maximum core. I agree with you. The performance advantages of this system are not, they don't jump out at you. They're not really there. Like if you're looking for getting 10 degrees Celsius lower with the Coolant's EXT440CU compared to, say, like the Corsair H100i or even the kind of the standard thermal right heatsink that you mentioned there, it's just not there. One thing that we're working on right now to expand on this story is to get a GPU water cooled as well, because one of the advantages this will have is, in theory, because of its additional power and its additional flow rates and stuff like that, it should be able to cool both the CPU and the GPU and keep very similar temperatures to what you see there now. And with an H100i you don't get that, and with the kind of, obviously with a standard heatsink you don't get that. So the idea is we may be hitting kind of like the thermal limit of the water block as opposed to the thermal limit of the cooler, the whole system as it's in its entirety, right? The idea is maybe you hook up your CPU and your GPU up to it, and if you're still maintaining the same temperatures on that water block onto that processor, then okay, now you have an advantage that you can claim over the less expensive like Corsair H100i and those types of things, regardless if you're using a Ivy Bridge or Haswell or anything like that. The only other thing worth noting is that the noise levels of say the Thermalright Silver Arrow were 8 decibels higher than the Coolant at its maximum setting, 16 decibels higher with the Coolant at its medium setting, and if my math works out here, 25 decibels higher with the Coolant at its lowest setting. So there is some potential noise sound quality advantages, because if you look all the way back up at the CPU stock settings on the Ivy Bridge part, the Coolant with the pump and fans set to speed 1, you're talking about basically the same temperature as the Corsair H100i, 41 degrees, but at lower sound levels by quite a bit. 34 dBA is really, really, really quiet. So there are some potentials there, but I think the real potential in a system like this is expansion and beyond just kind of cooling just that CPU. But it does also look pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean it's back and forth, because at least one of the configurations, I think the Haswell, was the Haswell, yeah, the Coolant wouldn't actually keep the processor stable in pump fan 1 mode or single fan mode.
Absolutely. You do have to make sure you're hitting performance metrics that you need to hit too.
Cooling GPUs though, this makes me very, very happy. This was, I think, my favorite PC case I saw at CES. I saw a lot of them. But the Corsair Obsidian 250D Mini ITX case, I like to call it Mini ITX when I'm with other people. you mock me, and you should, because I can't speak English and it's the only language I know. But this case, actually, this is something like Ryan and I have both been really into Mini ITX cases lately. And this one has an amazing layout. It is compact. I think it looks smaller in real life than it does in that picture. And you did a full kind of video preview and build up, and it's pretty slick how you set this thing up.
Yeah, the 250D is an interesting case. So it's Corsair's first Mini ITX. I would say that in person, the 250D is actually bigger than most of the other Mini ITX cases we've used, which is good and bad, right? It's good in that when you're working inside of it, It provides you a lot of room. You have a five and a quarter inch drive bay for an optical drive if you want to do that. You've got room for water cooling. You've got room for a full-size graphics card. You can use a full-size ATX power supply. And you have some room for, like, cable clutter, right? You know, whereas a lot of times when you have mini ITX design, any extra cables cause massive headaches in terms of cable routing or space or airflow or anything like that, right? So this case gets around that by being a little bit bigger. So when you install your components in it, it's not that hard. And when you have some extra cables from the power supply, you can tuck them in kind of in the lower level of it, and it works just fine. Now, the bad side to that is that it's a bigger case, right? So obviously one of the big draws of a mini ITX system design is that it's a super small form factor design that maybe you can leave on your desk or, you know, whatever, something like that. And we've seen like Lian Li Q33 or what's the other one we've looked at recently? Like the Silverstone RVZ01, which is like a desktop type, like lay flat design that they're smaller, they're harder to work in, but they're smaller, right? Mm-hmm. So it's, you really kind of got to judge what you're looking for here, right? It only fits a mini ITX motherboard. So, you know, you're kind of limited by the motherboard you pick. But then, you know, you can put basically any dual slot graphics card in there, any power supply. You've got room for 2 3.5 inch drives, 2 2.5 inch drives. You can put even an H100i, which is a double rad, a 240 millimeter radiator in there. You can put, you know, the H180i, and you've got plenty of capability in the case, as long as you're okay with your mini ITX design being maybe a little bit bigger than other mini ITX designs. I'm curious, we have a case in here that we haven't actually tested yet. It's a Bitphoenix Colossus M, and it's a micro ATX case. So it fits the next size up in motherboard, but based on the size of the box and what I think the case is inside of it, I don't think it's going to be much bigger than the 250D. Physically. So I'll be curious to see kind of what the trade-offs are between like these kind of directly competing cases, right? So a mini ITX that gives you room to use a lot of full-size components, high-performance components, versus maybe a micro ATX that's a little bit more restrictive for its particular size. But it's I actually like the case. It's got great fan filters. I like the window on top that it gives you, like when it's all buttoned up together, there's a window on top. So if you've got anything with LED lights on it, it's going to look pretty neat. And it's also relatively cheap, like $90, I think. So if you compare that to like the EVGA Hadron Air, which is like $180 and it's one of those really small mini ITX cases that's also really hard to get your hands in and actually get things done. We basically had no installation concerns with the Corsair 250D at all, which I think will be a big plus for a lot of people. It just depends on what you're looking for. So I don't really know. Like, it's not a slam dunk win, but it's pretty good for their first choice. It has a lot of the stylings and features that you would expect from the other Corsair Obsidian lines as well.
So while we're talking about small cases, let's talk about the less expensive GPU. Mr. Ryan Shrout and the AMD Radeon R7 265 2GB review, quote, Pitcairn takes another pass. Is this the $200 graphics card of choice, or is it just another GPU
It's actually the $150 graphics card of choice. So this is a weird part, right? So it's an R7 265. As the name would imply, it puts it between the 260X and the 270. But it, in terms of the actual GPU on the card, it's much closer to the performance of the R9 270 than it is the R7 260X. Like, pretty dramatically close, actually, where it's kind of to the point where, remember when the R9 290 came out, we said this kind of undercuts the ability of the R9 290X to sell because it was very close in performance for quite a bit less money. The same can kind of be said here for the R7 265. I'd say it's within 10% of the performance of the R9 270, and it's $149 instead of $229, right? Like, yeah, that's a huge gap.
You look at the R7 260X, and it's 128-bit memory interface. It's you know, running at 1100 hertz. It's got this super fast 6500 megahertz memory clock, but it's only got 196 CUDA cores. Excuse me. I am so sorry, AMD. GPU cores.
Yeah.
Would to hang my head in shame now. You know, 56 texture units. And then you look at the, you know, for another $30, which is a significant chunk of the cost of the 260X. But if you can save up another $30, if you can skip, like, you know, McDonald's for a couple of weeks, you're looking at 1,024 cores, you know, and you know, a seemingly slower 5,600 megahertz memory clock, but you're doubling the memory interface to 256 bits. This is a big deal. That's a lot of cores and a lot of bandwidth for not much more money.
If you look on that table on the first page of our review, the main thing to pay attention to is the 270X, the 270, and the 265 all use Pitcairn GPU, right? The 265 has fewer shaders. It's 1024 instead of 1280, like you said. But then that combination of the double the size memory bandwidth, memory interface, and memory clock, you're talking about 179 gigs per second memory bandwidth versus 104 for the 260X, right? That's a huge gap. And so if you look at the peak compute performance, you're talking about 1.89 teraflops versus 1.97, which in theory would give the 260X better theoretical performance. But as you clearly see in the benchmarks, that is not even close to being the case. It's not even close.
The difference between theory and practice is that in theory, there's no difference between theory and practice. But seriously, so what's the cruelest benchmark to compare these two cards on?
Even if you look at Battlefield 4, if you go to Battlefield 4 and you look at the benchmark results, the main graph that I want you to pay attention to is the one that's titled FPS by percentile. And the reason you look at that one is because the leftmost data point is the 50th percentile, which gives you essentially the average frame rate of these games. So what you see at the top line that's green is the R9 270. It's the highest. Okay, right below that, basically tied, is the R7 265 and the NVIDIA GeForce GTX 660. And then you see quite a bit down is the orange line of the 260X, and then below that is the GTX 650 Ti from NVIDIA. So you're talking about a The 260X is 32% slower than the R7 265, the new card, whereas the new card is only 10% slower than the R9 270. So that's kind of more or less the repeated pattern throughout the benchmarks. And it basically makes the $149 R7 265 like the best mainstream graphics card in terms of performance per dollar that you'll be able to buy. The problem that we have with this card is it's not for sale today. It's not going to be for sale till the end of February or early March. I'm going to lean towards early March on this. And the R9 270's MSRP is $179.
Right.
As I wrote this review, the cheapest you could find that card for was $229. That's a $50 markup or somewhere between 25 and 35% higher than it should be. Now, we can get into the argument of whether that's because of GPU shortages or because of, Litecoin mining or because of both of those things. But the point is that it's selling for way over its MSRP.
Okay.
And I see no reason why that won't happen to the 265 as well.
Essentially, it's so close to the 270.
Exactly. Exactly. It's essentially the same GPU. The dirty little secret is the card that we got, the review card that we got, was actually an R9 270 graphics card. Like, if you look at that picture, the two on the right, one of those is the R9 270, one of them is the R7 265. You can't tell them apart because the only difference is one of them had a BIOS flashed between them to slow it down for our testing purposes, the RS7 265. So it wouldn't surprise me if this card actually becomes more popular for miners because it's only $150, at least at first.
You'll be
able to maybe hack a BIOS onto it and take it up to a 270X, right?
That would be really cool. And yeah, I mean, if you can buy it for the MSRP, then you're looking at getting GTX 660 performance for a quarter less, you know, 25% less cash outlay.
The unfortunate part about it is, like I wrote in the review, like this is the best $150 video card you can buy. if you could buy it. And you can't buy it today because it's not actually out. And it's very possible that when this thing comes out, you still won't be able to buy it for $150. And if this happens to AMD again, it's at some point we have to draw a line in the sand and say, okay, AMD, you've got to do something about this, or we can't talk about your products in this in the way you want us to, right? They want us to talk about MSRP and that Newegg and Amazon's markups are really the retailer's problems, not AMD's problems. And that can only last for so long. So like the R7-265 is a great card. If it comes out at that price, if it becomes available at that price, and you know, actual gamers, PC gamers can buy it for that, it could be a great card. It will be a great card if they can do that. I don't know when to start not believing what they're telling me is going to happen, right? They don't have total control over it, but they have more control over it than I think they're trying right now, maybe.
Pump out more chips. We touched on it briefly last week. I feel like we touched on it briefly last week. Or maybe it was the 240. But AMD launches the Radeon R7 250X at $99. The HD 770 Redux. Redo. I like saying Redux. I'm confusing this with the 240 because I saw the Radeon R7 240 and realized it would be... So remember when I was building a FreeNAS box and the motherboard died and I had to buy another motherboard, but there were basically no 1155 motherboards in the Bay Area and I needed one right now that had... GPUs built in on the motherboard or graphics on the motherboard. So I've been running like a 3-year-old graphic card in it. And I was thinking like, I want something that consumes less power and the fan will never go on. And I saw the 240 and I was very excited because it's a 30-watt part, 30-watt GDP. $79 I don't want to spend, but I will spend it to complete this system and not have a howling 5-year-old graphics card inside of it again. You know, the 240, the 270... Entry-level gaming, better than an APU, tied with an APU. Who's outside of like people like me who, okay, you know, who need to see a monitor but need zero in terms of 3D performance? Who's really looking at these cards?
It's definitely better than an APU. Even the new flagship A10 parts that they're using now, Kaveri, the 250X will be faster than it, right? So the 250X has 640 stream processors. The Kaveri, top end Kaveri, has 512 and they're running at 700 something megahertz. This is running at 1000 megahertz. So it's definitely going to be faster. It's got better access to memory, much higher memory bandwidth, but it's not going to be tremendously faster. You will be able to pair this card up with those APUs to do dual graphics, right? So for $100, you can add this to your A10 system or your A8 system and see improved GPU, you know, gaming performance that way. It's always a weird discussion for me when we get down to this $100 price point, right? Who's buying a $100 video card? And the answer is somebody, and a lot of somebodies, because they're the highest, you know, volume parts by far. So who's buying them and what are they buying them for? It's a really interesting question. And actually, we're working on something in the next week or so where we kind of go out, buy like off-the-shelf desktop PCs and throw in one of these cheap low-end graphics cards, mainstream graphics cards, and see what does it actually do? Like, is it actually worth it to do this? And the answer is surprisingly yes, most of the time, right? So, it's an odd card. Like this is not a gaming card, not really. They'll tell you it'll do 1080p on some games, and it'll be able to hit 30 frames per second. You're gonna have to run like, you know, Battlefield 4 at lower image quality settings. But if you play things like World of Tanks or Dota 2 or League of Legends or StarCraft, like, This graphics card will absolutely perform admirably in those titles, right? These lower, less intense graphically games, right? So Battlefield 4 is going to be a stretch. Metro 2033 is going to be a stretch. BioShock Infinite is going to be a stretch. But for everybody else, I think this does pretty good in that ultra mainstream gaming segment. This is actually a card that you'll be able to buy for its MSRP, would be my guess. Which is a plus. I don't think we'll see the huge markups that we would maybe see otherwise in these. Although this does have about 60% of the CUDA cores. I'm sorry, I did it just like you did. 60% of the GPU cores,
right.
The 265, running at a little bit higher clock speed, and it's 50% less money. So maybe it'd be mining capable. I don't know at this point. It could be anything. It's hard to say.
It's funny looking at the chat room. Doc's like, you know, sub-$100 video card buyer, Photoshop or Lightroom. Dude's fried. It's a GPU destined for IGP then. Then there was laughter. Probably nice for a home theater PC, says Erratic One. You know, it's funny. Arbiter, Battlefield 4, 30 frames per second, not playable. Yes, which is why I shouldn't be trying to game on 4K home theater boxes. It's interesting, though. There's a lot of people who aren't looking for a ton of performance that could use a better GPU. I'm excited to see that that wrapped up. I wait with bated breath. I do not wait with bated breath over the latest news from IBM. Sad but true, Big Blue, quote, considering leaving chip manufacturing, which is, I like Scott's comment. Well, this is something which I expect they will not sell to Lenovo. IBM, one of the world's most advanced chip fabrication companies with the capability to manufacture on a 22-nanometer mode, or node, as people who can speak say it, is looking to sell this division. According to the Financial Times, via Ars Technica, the company selected Goldman Sachs to seed options. They are primarily looking for interested buyers, but would also consider finding a business partner to offload the division into a joint venture. Obviously, GlobalFoundries and TSMC would like that. Well-tested, well-proven, and probably well-partnered out with customers fab from IBM. And it's funny, apparently they're not willing to get rid of their chip design ability because basically they're still churning out chips based on the power architecture. It's interesting stuff. Interesting stuff. So, yeah, I don't know. I'll be curious. I'll be curious to see what happens. It's so odd. I get that IBM is a services company, but it hurt a little bit when they got rid of ThinkPad. And, you know, yep. It's just weird. It's like they're walking away from everything that made IBM IBM. But I'm sure a lot of people in, you know, 1978 were thinking, this XT business, it's just not IBM. I don't understand what they're doing.
Probably.
You know, I remember them. I didn't know any IT managers at that point or IBM employees because I was seven, or eight or something. But it's an interesting thought. It's weird. Times change, people, and you best change with them. You know what else you might want to change? Your cell phone provider. Look, I'm a customer of Ting. I'm a customer of another cell phone purveyor, if you will. And if I decide to leave my cell phone purveyor and there's an opportunity to pay an early termination fee, Ting will actually help pay that early termination fee. But the reason I want to tell you about Ting because they're a sponsor, not just because they're a sponsor. I'm a customer. I pay out of my own pocket for this. But it's really simple. The difference between Ting and the other provider I use is Ting answers the phone when I call. They give me service that I use. I've only needed to use the service once, so I don't really think about service for a cell phone. What I do think about is the giant-ass bill I usually pay. And Sprint isn't like that. They're an OBS mobile service. Unlimited devices on one plan. Basically, every device you had, let's say you got four people in the family and you get four phones, each plan is going to cost a flat $6 per month. And then if you consume all of the data, you pay more money. If you don't consume a lot of data, you pay less money. And by the way, you're consuming even less, or I should say paying even less, no matter how much data you're consuming, because they basically just got better pricing from Sprint and they are passing it on to their customers like me, which is great because I have a wireless hotspot that I use with Ting along with a phone that my Android phone is on Ting. And it's really cool. Check out the savings calculator on Ting. Look at the fact that they are giving you a ton of services. There's no really irritating things. Like, you're not paying extra. There's no fee for voicemail. There's no fee for tethering. There's no fee for using your phone as a hotspot. There's no fee for additional features. It's all in there. There's no contract. You go month to month. You want to leave Ting? Buy. And the key to that is owning your own hardware. And that's the kind of thing that makes Ting different. They're not going to be like, we're going to give you an $800 phone for $100. And they're going to make $3,000 off you because of the plans they've got you on. Ting is basically going to charge you the minimum pricing for the amount of phone calls or texts or data that you use every month. You ratchet it down to extra small. And if you go over, if you use a gigabyte of data instead of 100 megabytes, guess what? They're going to charge you a little bit more. There's no punitive fees. There's no ridiculous overage charges. There's nothing that's going to make you weep in the night when you open up the cell phone bill. It's really, really cool. Purchase your mobile device from Ting. Bring over your favorite Sprint phone. There's a whole list of eligible phones. They tell you how to move it over. They've got hardware available on the website. And please do us a favor. Support the This Week in Computer Hardware. Visit Ting today at Twitch, TWICH.Ting.com. You're going to save money. You're going to better manage your mobile phone usage with Ting. Check out the savings calculator. You might be stunned. Figure out how much data you actually use. Figure out how many minutes of phone calling you actually make. Look at the text messages and see how much you or your company can save. And it's pretty cool because we're trying to help you out here. We're trying to help out Ting. This Week in Computer Hardware viewers also save $25 on the first Ting device when you sign up. So please support our sponsor and support Twitch by going to twitch.ting.com and start saving today. I like saving money, people. You should like saving money too. Just saying. It's a thing. Twitch at twit.tv is the email address. If you want to find Mr. Ryan Shrout on the Twitters, he is at Ryan Shrout. I am at Patrick Norton. And we have an email from Aiden about USB speed. Hi, Patrick and Ryan, your number one Irish fan here. Outstanding, Aiden. I have a top spec gaming machine. Recently, I've been moving videos of my nephew from my brother's laptop to my machine and have been using USB sticks to do so. USB 2.0. When taking them from my brother's laptop, they write to the USB drive at a minimum of 15 megabytes per second. But when I copy them back over from my PC to the USB after doing some editing for my brother, the max speed I get is 5 megabytes per second. Can either of you advise how I can test where the problem is coming from? Thanks a million and keep up the good work. So, what impacts USB speed?
Well, the first thing is I think if I were to advise him on how to test where the problem was coming from, I think we pretty much just did that. Like he's already doing it, right? So he says when he's copying stuff from his brother's laptop to the USB drive, it's like 15 megabytes per second. When he's copying it from his machine to the USB drive, it's like 5 megabytes per second. So the problem is going to be with his machine, right? Or at least how it functions with this particular USB drive. USB thumb drives, if you buy an inexpensive one, are notoriously known for being like wickedly slow. And you know, this is true of like the ones that, you know, when people hand me press kits at CES, you know, you plug it in and you're like, ooh, it's an 8 gig thumb drive or something like that. And then you try to copy something to it and it's in the single digit megabytes per second. And it's pretty painful. Usually the read speeds will be a lot faster, but the write speeds on it will be pretty painful. He says he's copying them from his PC. You might try other USB ports. If you're using front panel ones, maybe they're reacting differently, although they should all be coming from the same controller on the motherboard. You could try, like I said, try different USB ports. You could try, you know, if you have a thumb drive, you know, if you have multiple thumb drives, do the same test. Copy a, you know, a single large, like 1 gigabyte file from your PC to it and see what speed you get, and try it again on your brother's laptop. If his is, you know, faster on two or three other drives than yours, then there's something with your controller. You know, we don't really know if maybe you got a USB driver that needs to be installed on your machine or something like that. I'm guessing we're not talking about USB 3 devices at this point. He does say USB 2.
If you're getting those speeds from a USB 3 device that was actually plugged into a USB 3 port, I would be very, very upset.
that would be bad. I guess, 5 megabytes per second is really slow. It's really slow. I would expect you should be able to get in the 20s most of the time with a high quality USB drive.
I mean, it's kind of funny. Like, is it a very old machine? Is it plugged into a USB 1.0 port? Do you have USB 2.0 support? Do you have the latest USB drivers installed in your system? If for some reason it's a riser card or something, you know, do you have the latest firmware on your system? Do you have the latest Southbridge drivers on your system? Because, you know, what you kind of want to start is Once you make sure it's actually a USB 2.0 system, you want to make sure that the firmware is updated on the motherboard, the drivers are up to date on the system. You're not running a whole bunch of cruft in the background. Like maybe it turns out, you know, you have a whole bunch of viruses that are taking up, you know, CPU cycles on your system because USB performance is kind of dependent, or basically it normally sucks down a lot of CPU performance. Is your brother's machine a lot faster than yours? Does your brother's machine have a considerably faster hard drive than yours? There's a whole bunch of stuff to look at. Yeah.
Yeah, I would say, you know, if you don't have one already, like maybe you could go online and buy a thumb drive that's rated where you can actually see what the rated read and write speed is, and then test with that on your brother's machine and your machine and see where the differences lie there. If his actually goes up, you know, his write speed actually goes up, then and yours stays the same, then maybe, you know, it's possible. I don't know how old the motherboard is. Maybe it was in the transition from USB 1.1 to 2. That would be really old. But you might, maybe there's a BIOS setting that it enables USB, high speed USB or something like that. The only other thing that would normally do that is if you're transferring a lot of small files to a USB drive, you'll get a very low rated data rate. Even though it's, you know, normally faster. So if you want to check your sustained read and write speeds, you need to use like a single large 1, 2, 3 gigabyte, you know, video file or something like that. And that's how you'll get, you know, a good data point, I guess, for how your system is performing with it.
Got an email from Mars about PCs for designing. It says, I realize gamers own the discussion space when it comes to computer hardware, but it would be nice to hear some info for designers, Creative Suite and CAD, 3D CAD, and 3D modeling. There are thousands of upstart designers and product engineers that are not working for massive companies and are interested in the best bang for per buck builds. Resource info for designers building hardware is very limited. Thanks. It's a great question, Mars. In part, the reason we talk about gamers more than designers or CAD CAM designers or Photoshop jockeys, affectionately known term that a friend of mine taught me to call him as his professional career choice. I'm a Photoshop jockey. In any case, did I mention I was building a boat out of cardboard at 5 a.m. this morning? A very strange day and a very long one. But the reason we concentrate primarily on like desktop usage and mobile and games is that's where the most of the people are kind of thinking, like home theater PCs. The second reason is because a lot of the applications in the design community, once you get past stuff like Photoshop, you know, a Creative Suite, Adobe Premiere, they start getting very, very esoteric and they take a lot of knowledge to understand what's exactly impacting performance. And I got to say, a good place to start in many cases with the forums and the user groups that are around those platforms. Because if you're into a particular, you know, if you're into a particular CAD CAM design tool, there's probably somebody who's already figured out how to make it faster or what impacts performance the most and has some good advice for you. It's something I've kind of learned after watching this stuff over the years. Two, it can be really frustrating, you know, for something as common as Photoshop, because, you know, over the years, there have been so many changes to the way Photoshop handles things. And even within, you know, I can remember being in a situation where there was a Photoshop filter. And under 30 megabytes, it handled a filter in a particular, the filter used a certain amount of like CPU or GPU. And then over X number of megabytes, it would switch to a different algorithm. And it would change how it actually processed the data. It was maddening because we, you know, trying to figure out how to benchmark things using this was incredibly frustrating. But I think we can probably sit down and try to find some good general stuff. You know, the running joke, work with big Photoshop files, you're working with big video files, you're working with big audio files, you know, put pretty much all the memory you can afford in the machine. You know, try to have your app running on an SSD, try to have your files that you're working with running on an SSD, even if it has to be a second SSD. And, you know, I'll take a look. There was one amazing site and I cannot find it, no matter how hard I look at the internet, that had configuration information for really serious Creative Suite setups. And it was interesting to look at it because these people were desperately trying to create sort of workstation level graphics performance on consumer hardware, which brings us, I think, to Brian Trout's favorite GPU for extremely accurate calculations. Man, I'm going to try one last search for that.
Yeah, I'm not sure which one you're referring to either.
website. Well, the card I was thinking of is the one that did the double they mentioned about being up at 5 a.m.
Oh, you're talking about like the Titan?
Yeah, that's the one. Sorry, I'm a little slow.
So that's a card that actually has double floating point precision. It's mostly used for, yeah, like the high performance computing type stuff, right?
Oh, there it is. Oh, wow. Adobe finally put together a proper hardware performance white paper. This is very exciting. Adobe, you crazy kids, you. Apparently you're getting pissed off about being poached by Premiere. Sorry. But optimizing hardware systems for Adobe Premiere Pro CS6, After Effects, SpeedGrade, and Photoshop Extended CS6. And it's really funny because if you're a hardware geek, reading through stuff like the major hardware components, we will be covering four major areas of hardware when we discuss optimizing your system's performance. If you are already well-versed in the subject of computer hardware, you may skip straight to the section, identifying performance bottlenecks. So let's just skip right down to that. it's so cute. They have little pictures of everything. Hardware solutions. Identifying performance bottlenecks. Adobe Premiere Pro, After Effects, SpeedGrade, and Photoshop Extended each place unique demands on the major hardware components discussed above. And let's skip through the boilerplates. Basic system requirements makes me want to weep. A core performance feature in Adobe Premiere Pro is the Mercury Playback Engine, which optimizes video processing calculations during previewing, exporting, scrubbing, and other functions in addition to playback. MPE employs multi-threading to take advantage of multiple CPU cores, both real and virtual, to accelerate these functions. The speed of encoding and decoding the wide range of media types Adobe Premiere Pro handles is also dependent on your CPU. Additionally, if your computer has a CUDA-enabled NVIDIA graphics card or chip installed, it can also take advantage of a qualified GPU to greatly accelerate a number of functions up to 8 times that of high-end multi-core CPUs, according to NVIDIA. That's funny. Functions that are accelerated include a growing list of effects and transitions. See the accompanying sidebar. Scaling, including different pixel aspect ratios, deinterlacing, frame rate differences, blending modes, color space conversions, and alpha channel interpretations. There's a list of improved video cards. And it's kind of funny. So CUDA accelerated effects and transitions in the Adobe Premiere Pro CS6, additive dissolve, alpha adjust, basic 3D black and white, brightness and contrast, color balance, color pass, color replace, crop, cross dissolve, dip to black, dip to white, directional blur, drop shadow, extract, fast blur, fast color corrector. You know, I could go on like this for a while because I love reading those names. But, you know, NVIDIA CUDA for Windows, Tesla C2075, when paired with a Quadro card as part of an NVIDIA Maximus configured system, Quadro 6000, 5000, 4000, 2000, 2000D, 5010M. And then finally, GTX 580, 570, 470, and GTX 285. Yeah, it's really funny reading this. But like render times, for example, timeline in Adobe Premiere Pro CS6, 816 CPU only, 8 core, 3.2 gigahertz Xeon W5580 PC. 144 from 816 to 144 with a Quadro 2000 to 1 minute and 11 seconds on a Quadro 4000. And then you drop another 15 seconds if you go for an NVIDIA 2 card maximum system, which is like Quadro 2000 and a Tesla C27.5. That's a lot of money. You know, and then it basically says, add lots of memory. If you plan to be working with large image sizes, get a GPU with more than 1 gigabyte of VRAM. Do people still say VRAM, Ryan?
Well, obviously. Somebody does.
It's crazy. I mean, you know, to be processed with CUDA hardware acceleration, a frame requires 16,384 megabytes. If that value exceeds the available memory, Adobe Premiere Pro will use the CPU for rendering that of the current segment. This becomes a consideration for larger digital cinema formats. This is actually a really good read. I've been a little silly about it, but it's basically if you search for optimizing hardware systems for Adobe Premiere Pro CS6, After Effects CS6, SpeedGrade CS6, and Photoshop Extended CS6. It's actually, I mean, it's pretty interesting. You know, After Effects CS6 and Photoshop CS6 benefit the most from faster CPUs and more CPU cores. Indeed, given sufficient RAM, After Effects CS6 is capable of running multiple copies of itself on individual physical cores, speed previews, and rendering, which is really, really cool. But basically, you know, a big deal of it is lots and lots of RAM. And if you go into the efficiency indicator, we'd have an image open in Photoshop. It'll basically tells you when Photoshop maxes out on RAM and starts using the scratch disk. So if you are constantly hitting the efficiency indicator, basically when it's telling you you're maxing out on RAM, it's a little thing down at the bottom. It basically tells you if the efficiency value is below 100%, Photoshop is using the scratch disk and is therefore operating more slowly. And the lower the efficiency gets, the more time you're spending on scratch disk and the more time you're spending moving bits back and forth, and the more time you're wasting. So I'll say it one last time. Lots of memory is a good thing. Yeah. Sorry, I got excited about that. I didn't mean to start reading off specs. But Mars, I hope I have helped. Josh, of course, asked me for the link, and I found that right after I closed it. Hold on, Josh. It's too late now, Patrick.
Moment has passed.
What has not passed is an email from Graham about GPU upgrades and coolers. He says I currently have a Sapphire Pro Radeon HD 6850. I recently purchased an Zen ZXT Kraken G10 bracket that I discovered thanks to a PC Per article. I'm not entirely sure if the 6850 is using the reference PCB or not. I won't really find out until the Kraken gets here. I am in the slightly delayed second batch. My question is this. If I have to upgrade from the HD 6850 to something new in order to use the Kraken, what's a good sub-$200 card that will either match or beat the 6850 in performance and use a reference PCB? Is this a tall order?
The tough part with that was going to be reference PCB. The card we just talked about today, the R7-265, should be compatible with the Kraken, even in its retail configurations. It should still have the same mounting hole mechanism. It's the same card. It's essentially the same GPU and die as the Radeon HD 7850. My issue will be I don't know how much of an upgrade that's going to be over the 6850. It will be some upgrade, but it may not be a whole lot. So if you stay on the AMD side, as it stands today, as we were just talking about, the R7-265, when it comes out later this month or early March, is supposed to be $150. And then the next step up is the R7-270, which is currently selling for about $229. So you don't really have a sub-$200 option from AMD currently and until the R7-265 really comes out. I was just going to do a quick check of the R9-270 to make sure that pricing issue is still correct. It was 2 days ago when I wrote that story. Yeah, I mean, you're still looking at $229 for it. So you don't really have a sub-$200 video card available for AMD today until you get down to the R7-260X, which is $120, which will definitely not be a performance upgrade for him over the 6850. So it sounds to me like if he wants to stick with AMD, he's going to have to wait until the R7-265 comes out, and that would probably be his best bet.
I like it. I want more. But you know what, ladies and gentlemen, we have to get Mr. Ryan Shroud home or he's going to be in big trouble and his wife's going to fly to California and beat me senseless and I'll be in big trouble. So ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank you all for watching this episode of Twitch. Twitch at twit.tv is the email address, at Ryan Shroud, at Patrick Norton. And please, if you haven't subscribed or if you just want to listen to every single episode of Twitch, go to twit.tv/Twitch and go forth and get the RSS on. Look for us in iTunes or whatever your favorite podcatcher is. And please tell your friends about us. I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Shroud.
We'll see you next week on Twitch.